This is Car Expert.
We worked out that you'd need to own the hybrid for about 80,000 Ks or so before you get your money back.
It's genuinely refined around town, fun when you take it to a fun road. Dynamically, it's the whole package.
I'm glad Hyundai hasn't done what Mazda and Toyota did with their hatchbacks and just astronomically jacked up prices.
Hello, my name is Mandy Turner, and hello to Paul Marrick.
G'day, Mandy. How are you?
Very good, thank you. And g'day to William Stopford.
Hey, Mandy.
A bit of big news in the Australian automotive publishing world this week, Paul, with the old place.
Yes, that's right, the old place. The old place is Car Advice. We saw the announcement this week that Channel 9 has decided to shut Car Advice down and instead go with Drive as their main motoring outlet. So it was a bit of a sad day for us given our history with the brand. Elbows, Tony and I have been there for, I think, 14 or 15 years. Oh, had been there 14 or 15 years. So it was sad to see that that disappear and you know, it'll be interesting to see how it all goes. So, yeah, we wish everyone all the best there and hope that it all sort of ends up working out for everyone and that everyone keeps their jobs and all that sort of stuff. But, I guess we're excited to see what happens. We're all for more competition because at the end of the day, a car buyer needs to have as many independent sources as they can when it comes to buying a new car. And you also need to have that balance of power. The more the car company has power in terms of content, the more sponsored and rubbish content you're going to see that doesn't really help any buying processes. So, yeah, just interesting and wishing them all the best.
Are you able to divulge the words of Elbors and what he thinks of all this? Because he was the one who started up Car Advice all those many years ago. He must feel a tinge of sadness there, surely.
Well, absolutely. And hopefully in a few years' time, we can buy it back for a dollar. We're going to pass the hat around and we'll see what happens. But, he is sad as well. Well, he's a sad person, just sort of in general, but he was quite sad about that. So, it's one of those things. Like, he started that from nothing, effectively. And, it was nothing until Tony and I joined. But it was, it's taken a long time to build. And, it is sad to see them decide to go with the other brand that, I don't know, based on the feedback I've heard, that no one's really ever heard of. So it's surprising. So, like I said, wish them all the best and let's see what happens, I guess.
Yeah, we certainly do. Moving on to something a bit lighthearted, I thought this might be a bit of a fun topic to talk about. So I've moved into a new house this week and I'm currently recording this in the garage, which is cool. And there's been a car that's been blocking the driveway after a party for about 2-3 days now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an old Holden Epica.
Oh.
So excellent taste in cars.
Wow. Yep.
And my housemate and I are trying to figure out a really cheeky sign to leave on the windshield because they're going to know it's us without being too rude. So have you guys ever put a bad parking sign on a windshield before?
I put a polite bad parking sign. I used to live in an apartment complex and we had a clearly, demarcated visitors parking area. And then there were all the individual spots for each of the apartments. And somebody I want to say it was like a Range Rover Sport or something. They just parked in my spot, which, it was one of the larger spots in the complex. So I understand why. But I left them a note. At first I thought, well, maybe I'll leave them a really bitchy note. But then I thought, no, I'll just say, oh, hey, just in case you didn't notice, the visitors parking is actually located to the right of the complex. You've actually parked in it, and it was all really polite. And I came back to that spot later in the day and the Range Rover had gone and there was a note under a rock. And it was like a really nice reply letter saying, oh, look, I'm really sorry. I didn't know where the visitors parking was. I'm really sorry for any inconvenience. So, all's well that ends well. So if I'd left a snarky note and it was an honest mistake, that person would have felt really crap but that being said, parking in front of a driveway, come on, get them towed.
I know.
Yeah, well, I've actually had two experiences, one that went well and then one that didn't. And it was the same story in an apartment building. Someone parked in our parking space and they parked in there when my wife came home from she's a shift worker. She came home from work and the car was there and I thought, oh, I'm going to go leave a note and just let them know how annoying it is what they've done. And anyway, we came back and I didn't leave a very polite note and came back because the spots were very clearly marked. And the note was on the ground scrunched up and the car was gone. And I thought, oh, you so-and-sos. The second time, though, I actually had a note left on me because we had hired two parking spaces in a building where our new office is. And we'd been parking there for 6 months. And I got a note saying, can you please move your cars? You're in our parking spot. We're moving in. It was a very nice note. And I messaged the person we were renting these parks from and I said, listen, what's the go here? Have you just moved and just kept taking our money? And they go, no, you're still allowed to park there. And they go, which park are you in? And I said, oh, the one that's labelled, 402. And they're like, oh, no, you're parking in the wrong spots. So for 6 months, we'd been parking in the wrong parking bays. And thankfully, the person was very understanding and they left a polite note. So
why did it take them 6 months, though?
I don't know. I think it must have been vacant and then someone has moved in and discovered that our cars were there. So, yeah, I think there's two ways of playing it. And I'd probably go down the path of a polite note. With a driveway, I think it's pretty obvious that, unless they thought that maybe the house was still vacant, Mandy.
No.
Well, here's the other thing. They probably are stupid because when the marketing came out for the Epica, I remember the PR person telling us that it had a Porsche-derived flat six. And I thought, oh, it must be sporty. And then I drove it and, oh, it is an absolute heap of junk. So, yeah. I think that the person probably knows exactly what they're doing.
Oh, I don't think it's ever been washed and it's got a space saver wheel on the front that I don't think has ever been, replaced. So I'm not surprised. All right, let's get into this week's podcast. Starting off with this week's car news, yet another special edition for the 2021 Volkswagen Golf GTI wheel. It's called the Club Sport and are we going to get it here?
We are not. But,
damn.
Exactly. Sorry to let down a Volkswagen fan. That's not to say we won't get anything like it. So we spoke with Volkswagen Australia and they did say that obviously special editions are important to them and they have the ability to spec their own and that there will be special editions like this going forward, but it might not take this form or be called a Club Sport. So this is the first special edition of the new Mark 8, and the Mark 8 actually isn't even here yet. It's arriving, I believe, Q1 of next year, and that'll be the GTI and the rest of the regular Golf range. So the Club Sport is interesting. It has 41 kilowatts of power and 30 newton meters more torque than the Mark 8 GTI. So that's a total of 221 kilowatts of power, or that's around 300 horsepower and 400 newton meters of torque. Volkswagen's claimed a 0 to 100 kilometer time of under six seconds. They haven't said exactly how far under, whereas the regular GTI has got a claim time of 6.3 seconds. I think the most interesting thing about this special edition, so adaptive chassis control is optional on it, and there's an additional drive mode. So you got your Eco, Comfort, Sport, and Individual, but there's one called Special. And it is special because it's actually been adapted specifically for driving on the Nordschleife. So it softens the suspension a little bit compared to sport mode because obviously the very undulating nature of that track means you don't want something really stiffly suspended when you're driving on there. So that's a little fun inclusion that they've put in there. And another interesting thing that Volkswagen has said is that they claim to have completely eliminated the understeer that is typical of front-wheel drive vehicles. So it is sad that we won't be getting this Club Sport, but it bodes well for future special edition Golf GTI variants that we will get.
I feel special driving mode is more suited to Australian roads than the Nordschleife.
Well, Mandy, I'm just curious how they've eliminated understeer. That's like a world first. Or is that some marketing person just running away with some facts there?
That's why I said Volkswagen claims.
Yeah. Oh, look, we'll have to wait and see.
You never know. The previous gen of the Focus RS had this thing called the Revo Knuckle, and I remember driving that, and it was like it was an all-wheel drive car. So, look, maybe they have done something. It's just an incredible amount of power to be cramming through a set of front wheels to then have no understeer. So, yeah, good on them if they have.
Mm. Paul, the 2021 Chevrolet Corvette, for people who have put a deposit down, well, they're going to get a refund now.
Yeah, this is I don't really understand this. So they've taken – well, I think I do understand it. I think there's some politics at play here, and I think that a lot of people have gone to their Holden dealerships, put deposits down, and the dealers have taken that money. Now that the whole GMSV thing has come out, they've come out and said, no, we're going to refund all of you. You can actually place orders again mid-August once the actual network has been established. So I think they were concerned that perhaps some of these dealers were actually going to be closing and the money that was put in as a deposit would never actually be seen again. So look, this whole thing is truly bizarre. We've actually been trying to help a customer, a Holden customer, with an issue they're having with their car. And midway through helping them, the PR guy for Holden disappeared, and we've tried contacting other PR people that aren't in this country. No one's responding. It just truly boggles the mind. I've got no idea what's going on there, and it really doesn't give me much confidence if you're, you know, a Holden owner. How are you actually meant to get things fixed if no one's responding to any contact or emails? So, yeah, look, I'll be watching this closely, and hopefully we'll have some more news in the coming weeks on what's actually going on at Holden.
Paul, could this also, would it be no surprise that when the Corvette eventually does get here that the price may have changed?
Yeah, absolutely. So they were in a bit of a dilemma with Camaro because it was converted locally. The ZL1 had a, or ZL1, had a price tag of 160 grand before on-road costs. Now, given the price tag that the Corvette starts at, you would think that it will land somewhere around there by the time they get it locally. So you couldn't possibly sell a Corvette alongside a Camaro at the same price. So I think that's why the Camaro was axed. I think the price will be a lot more than everyone thinks it's going to be, and that will be simply so they can make a profit. It's not just going to be US dollar, convert to Australian dollar, and here's your price. And I don't think it'll be like a Tesla model where they adjust the price with the dollar going up and down. I think it'll just be a high margin product, and they probably won't sell a great deal of them, but I don't think they're going to be bargain basement cheap.
Mm. Will, what are your thoughts on this?
I just want it to come here. Please, yes. Just come here. And everyone keeps planting like the seed of doubt that, oh, no, now maybe it might not come here. We thought that the factory right-hand drive program, because we hadn't heard much about it for a little while. So it's like, well, is that up in the air? Because now GM has so few right-hand drive markets left. And obviously even here, you know, with Holden leaving and GMSV being primarily a local conversion outfit, I think a lot of people were worried that the C8 Corvette wouldn't even come here. So I just would really like it to come here. It's really sad to see the Camaro go. But although it will be, they will be racing the Camaro in V8 supercars.
Bizarre.
It's, yeah. But and it's really hard finding out what's actually happening with the future of the Camaro, because the last reports we heard from the US were that its future was in doubt and there wasn't a successor for it. But anyway, look, if we lose the Camaro but we get the Corvette, cool, awesome. But the Corvette just needs to come here, and it will be really, really amazing to get behind the wheel of one, because by all accounts, it's a really impressive vehicle.
Yeah, we're looking forward to getting behind the wheel too. Now, pricing and specs have lobbed for the 2021 Hyundai i30 hatch, which sees it getting a bit of a refresh. The base Go is no more. Instead, it's now called just i30, which now has the $1,750 full active safety suite now standard, but it pushes the final price to $3,000 more overall. The Active, Elite, N-Line and N-Line Premium remain, with the latter now including a manual transmission. Yay for purists. On the outside of the i30, new daytime running lights are integrated into the bumper. However, the N-Line and N-Line Premium are sticking to the current design we know now. Further up the spec models, you get a new 10.25-inch infotainment system and digital instrument binnacle. Prices start at $23,420 for the i30 manual and creep up to $36,220 for the N-Line Premium Auto. The i30 Active and Elite, they come standard with a naturally aspirated 2-litre four-cylinder engine. It's got 120 kilowatts and 203 newton metres of torque. You get a choice of a six-speed manual or a six-speed auto. And standard on the i30 N-Line and N-Line Premium is a turbocharged 1.6-litre four-cylinder engine with 150 kilowatts of power and 265 newton metres of torque. You get a choice of a six-speed manual and a seven-speed dual clutch automatic transmission. It's optional on the N-Line.
I'm glad Hyundai hasn't done what Mazda and Toyota did with their hatchbacks and just astronomically jacked up prices. But I think that doesn't bode well for the next generation of this car. I suspect that's going to creep up into that territory.
And there's a little quirk here as well. We don't get all of the changes that have been rolled out to the European market model because our i30 is a source from South Korea and not from Europe, which does mean that our i30 does look a little bit different to the European market one. And there's just some strange aspects of this update. So the N-Line keeps a different appearance from the non-N-Line models, but it keeps the older appearance instead of getting updated to look like the European N-Line. And that also means that it doesn't have blind spot monitoring and rear cross traffic alerts still. So the only way to get an i30 with those two safety features, which once you have a car with them, in my opinion, it's hard to go back. You have to get the Elite, which has the naturally aspirated 2-liter. So you can't get the turbo 1.6 with those safety features. So you're actually, when you get to the two highest trim levels in the range, you're actually dropping a couple of features, which is just a baffling omission, and I really don't care for that. Also, as much as the N-Line looks nice, it would have been nice to get a little bit of a visual update here, especially because I will say the facelift that's been applied to the other models, not bad. It looks all right.
Will, some super exciting news. The 2021 Ford Mustang Mach-1 is coming to Australia.
So, yes, and it will be arriving in the second quarter of next year. So it is a limited run model, just 700 are coming. That's similar to the number of Bullets that came here in 2019. So it sits above the four-cylinder Mustang High Performance and the V8 Mustang GT. Local pricing and specs haven't been revealed yet, but we do know that the US market model has a naturally aspirated 5-litre Coyote V8. Gotta love Ford engine names. with 358 kilowatts of power and 570 newton metres of torque, which is a little bit up on the GT locally. It's got 339 kilowatts of power and 556 newton metres of torque. In the US, it's available with a 6-speed manual and the 10-speed automatic. So it'll be very interesting if we know that at least the manual is coming here, but we don't know about the automatic. And effectively, it bridges the gap between the Mustang GT and the Shelby models, which we don't get, unfortunately. Although we do get, we have gotten the Mustang R-Spec, and Herod Performances recently revealed the Mustang SM17. But take some bits and pieces from the Shelby GT500, so it borrows its rear axle cooler and its lower diffuser from there. Look, I will say the Bullet is gorgeous. I'm so jealous of Anthony Crawford and his gorgeous Bullet in that Highland green metallic with the black wheels. Everything about it looks great. The Mark 1 still looks really good. It's got the kind of retro badging and stripes that you would expect of it, because this is one of the oldest kind of variant names in Mustang history. So the Mark 1 first appeared in 1969 in the final years of the first generation, unless you count the 71 or 73 models as part of the first generation. That's another debate for another day. And it actually continued along into the 71 to 73 model. So this was the biggest, baddest Mustang that you could get, basically. You could only get it as a fastback. And then it carried on for a few more years before being retired. So it is a very old nameplate that they have dusted off, but it's a nameplate that's got a lot of heritage.
Which Mark 1 would you own, Will?
Historically speaking, look, I don't know. I'm a big fan of the 71 to 73 Mustangs because they don't seem to get a lot of love. What I find really funny about Mustangs, and I don't want to go on a rant here, but I don't know about you guys in Victoria, but up here in Queensland, there's like a 64 to 66 Mustang on like every street corner. And yes. Yeah, sure, they did sell a few here, like they, but it was a very limited run batch that came here. And I swear, you know, when people are like, oh, I want to get a classic car, it's just the default. Oh, just get a first generation Mustang. So they're great, you know, great looking cars, but I'm sick of them. I don't ever want to see another one of them. Whereas the 71 to 73s, you go to like an all-American day at like at a car show and you won't see a 71 to 73, even though the original Eleanor in Gone in 60 Seconds was a 73 Mustang Mark 1, and Diamonds Are Forever, which is the worst James Bond movie, by the way. he drove around a Mustang, 71 to 73 Mustang, so that's the one I would get. It was very interesting when I was just putting together this article on the Mark One. I was talking about historical Mark Ones, and the nameplate carried over into the downsized Mustang II, which was loosely based on the Ford Pinto. And that was, fun fact for everybody listening today, 1974 was the only year in Mustang history where it was not available with a V8 engine in the US market. Yeah. So there you go.
Wow. What did it have?
It had a 2.8-litre V6 sourced from Ford of Europe. There was a V8 available in the Mexican market Mustang too. I can't remember why that wasn't in the US, but they very quickly realized their mistake because they were trying to reposition the Mustang. They downsized it so much, they were clearly trying to reposition it as more of a rival for like the Toyota Celica, and then realized, oh, wait, no, it's a Mustang. Needs to have a V8. It's a 75. You could get one again.
Oh, God. I'm glad they realized that. I love that. Head to carexpert.com.au, click on the news link to get your news fix. Volkswagen's golf-sized SUV, the T-Roc, is out, and Will has reviewed it. Will, a little while ago on the podcast, you reviewed the smaller T-Cross. So how would you compare it with the T-Roc?
I'd say this is a hell of a lot more fun to drive. The T-Cross is a you know, it's a good little light SUV. It's got a good powertrain. It's got the little turbocharged three-pot under the hood. It's a nice little SUV. And when I was when I got the keys to the T-Roc, I thought, well, this is going to feel much, and it's just a little bit bigger. But it drives so much more differently. So this is more closely related to the Golf rather than the T-Cross, which is more closely related to the Polo. And I drove the T-Roc 140 TSI Sport, which is $40,490 before on-road costs. There is a cheaper T-Roc coming, which is the 110 TSI style, and that will be front-wheel drive only, and that will be a little bit cheaper. But this T-Roc really impressed me because it is fun to drive, and I don't have to add that little qualifier at the end for an SUV. It is actually legitimately an enjoyable drive. What I find very interesting, so in my review, I talk about how it's a really good kind of compromise car. If you've got a partner, your husband or wife or whatever, really wants an SUV, but you want something that's actually, you know, fun to drive and doesn't suck your soul as you're driving it. And so it's a really good compromise car in that respect because it's ostensibly an SUV. It kind of looks like an SUV to some people, although to me it kind of really just looks like a hatchback. So you might be able to trick your partner, trick your gullible spouse into convincing it's an SUV and they should get it. But you'll actually have something enjoyable to drive as well because it is – all-wheel drive. So if you think of this as a Golf hatchback, this is actually the cheapest way to get an all-wheel drive Golf hatchback. You can get a Golf all-track 132 TSI for about $4,000 less. But I don't know about you, if you've got a partner that really wants an SUV and you suggest to them, well, why not this wagon? And they you point out a Golf all-track, they're probably not going to have a very good reaction to that.
Not unless they're 70.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, a lot of us enthusiasts, you know, we love wagons, but convincing the general public to buy a wagon is generally quite hard, no matter how much plastic cladding you put on it. Whereas a T-Roc, yeah, it looks kind of SUV-ish. It doesn't actually feel especially like an SUV when you're driving it, though, because the driving position isn't even particularly high. But that just means that it doesn't have that kind of tippy high center of gravity feeling that a lot of SUVs have. That means you slow down more for a corner than you do for a passenger car. This, I did actually take it up to Mount Glorious twice because it was genuinely a good steer, but that's not just that doesn't just mean that it's fun to drive in the twisties and unpleasant elsewhere, because the ride quality is good and it's really, really quiet and refined. And that also includes the dual clutch automatic. I didn't really experience much of that kind of jerky kind of vibration that you get sometimes with dual clutches. It's genuinely refined around town, fun when you take it to a fun road. Dynamically, at least, it's the whole package.
Hmm. Was there anything that you didn't like about it?
Yeah. Here comes the but. That is that interior. No, Volkswagen, come on. We know you can do better, and that's what's frustrating. We know that Volkswagen can do really polished, classy interiors. Just go and sit in a Mark 7.5 Golf. Great interior. And then you sit in this or a T-Cross, and you've got the lovely, you know, digital instrument cluster and the nice infotainment system that you would expect of a Volkswagen. And the design is, you know, your classic, straightforward, conservative, but clean, elegant interior design that you expect of a Volkswagen. But the material quality is everything screwed together. But I think saying things didn't fall off while I was driving it is a pretty low bar. The material quality is just not great. It's certainly not good for a $40,000 SUV, and it's certainly not good when you compare it to a cheaper Golf. It's just hard plastic everywhere, and not just hard to feel, hard to look at.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. We spent some time in it over the past few days, and I actually drove this car in Germany last year on the way to the Frankfurt Motor Show. And the cool thing is it will do 200 Ks an hour just without any drama. So it is a cracking fun little car, but yeah, it is just let down by that interior. Just the materials are just so poor, and it feels like you're driving a van. You know, it's just really sort of low rent. I also didn't love the fact that with the infotainment system, there's no DAB radio, there's no voice recognition unless your smartphone's paired. And with that particular infotainment system, it won't display maps on the infotainment system and the digital display at the same time. You can only have one or the other, and that comes down to the graphics computing power. But yeah, it is a fun little car. And what surprises me is that if they had a benchmark in that segment, which is the CX-30 in terms of interior, that is so much more premium than this, you know, by a long stretch. So I have heard that there is a facelift to this vehicle coming that will have a nicer interior. So I guess our advice is you go test drive it, see what you think of it. But if interior quality is something that you want and you are sort of desperate for this car and you have your heart set on it, you may as well just wait a little bit longer and just see what this update looks like.
And it's about due for a midlife update pretty soon anyway. Even though it just came here, it's actually been on sale in Europe since 2017. Something else I found interesting, one of the commenters on the article today said, well, why not just get a Skoda Karoq? And that's something that we've also heard as well when we've been talking about the Volkswagen T-Cross. People have suggested, why not just get a Skoda Kamiq? And what's happening is Skoda is ostensibly a budget brand. Well, or at least it was at one point. But now Skodas sometimes have nicer interiors than Volkswagens and yet a still better value, which is really strange. You've got two brands there that have very similar positioning, but you can get a very different package.
Will, what car expert rating did you give it?
8.1 overall out of 10. So, look, it is genuinely a really good SUV. It is actually a small SUV that as I was driving, I thought, this is a small SUV I would actually like to own. But ultimately, that is a really dour, dreary interior, and that really does let it down because otherwise this car is genuinely so impressive. So I, as Paul said, can't wait for that mid-cycle update. Really hope they class the interior up a little bit there because then it would definitely get a higher score. And this might just be one of the best small SUVs in the segment.
Take a look at the review now at carexpert.com.au and let us know what you think in the comments.
Australia just absolutely loves the Toyota RAV4, with the hybrid taking Toyota by surprise with its popularity. But which do you buy, the hybrid or the petrol? Albus Fella decided to find out. Hello again, Albus.
Hello. How are you, Mandy?
Very good, thank you. So I want to know exactly how did you conduct this comparison?
Me too.
I as the expert comparison master that I am, I set out to do a comparison to prove that anyone that buys a hybrid is a moron. Unfortunately, I ended up proving that anyone that doesn't buy a hybrid is a moron. So basically, I proved that I'm a moron by the process. But anyway, the idea was pretty simple. We came up with a pretty reasonable loop that represented city driving, sort of highway driving, and a bit of sort of, I guess, twisty mountain driving in case you lived in a sort of a country area where you had to go up hills or things. And then we took the most efficient petrol non-hybrid RAV4 and the most inefficient hybrid RAV4, just to really skew the results as much as possible to demonstrate that even the heaviest of the RAV4s with the most equipment compared to the absolute lightest base model standard petrol was still more efficient. And we actually worked out that the hybrid, and I got to say, we swapped drivers in the middle. We did it really well. It was really quite actually scientific, dare I say. But the hybrid was ridiculously more efficient. It was actually annoyingly so more efficient. So we worked out that you'd need to basically own the hybrid for about only, 80,000 Ks or so before you get your money back. And that's about $2,500 more to go for the hybrid system. So, and most people that buy a RAV4 are going to do 80,000 kilometers during their ownership. So it really doesn't make any sense not to get the hybrid because it's actually a better car as well. It's quieter. It's got more power. There's a lot of things going for it. And also when you sell it, you're probably going to get more for it. So that $2,500 outlay, which you make back as it is in about 80,000 Ks, you're more likely going to get some of that back also when you come to sell the car. So again, as I said at the beginning, I proved that you're a moron if you don't buy the hybrid.
You know what? I think outside of just fuel economy, that hybrid is such a good car. Like it is, like you said, more responsive.
Can I just record that sentence and send it back about 8 years, Paul? Because do you remember like driving a Prius and wanting to hang yourself?
Exactly. But this is the thing. Toyota's finally realized that hybrids don't need to look like science projects. You can package them in a car that looks the exact same as the non-hybrid, and you have now a package that I could not fault when we tested it, and you would really be brain dead to go buy anything else in this segment. It is a really good all-rounder.
It is. And it's, like I said, it's the first time. I would usually tell people if you're buying an SUV and going to do lots of kilometers, consider buying a diesel, but I couldn't say that anymore. Hey, I would actually say, look at the RAV4 hybrid for the money, for an extra $2,500. You're getting, motors on the rear, you're getting, and from this model year 21, they're actually replacing the nickel hydride battery, which is what we tested with a lithium ion battery. So it'll be lighter, and I suspect it might even have slightly more capacity. So that might even do better than the current generation. So if you are ordering one, that's one thing to keep in mind, that try and get a model year 21 because it's actually got a new battery in it.
Well, my next question was to do with the capacity, Alborz. Did you find a big difference between the petrol and the hybrid in terms of space?
No, I think they're actually identical. The boots, okay. As far as I'm aware, they're actually...
Yeah, the batteries are under the rear seat.
Yeah, there's no compromise anymore to get a hybrid in terms of packaging. The only compromise is the weight. I think it's about, I can't remember the top of my head, but it's just about, just under 100 kilos or so from memory, heavier. However, again, it's still more efficient. So it goes to show you just how effective the current generation of hybrids are and how long it's taken to get here. It's been about 20 years since the Prius came out. So but you know now it actually makes sense.
You know what's cool as well, that when you do opt for the all-wheel drive hybrid, if you go for the top spec Edge model, which is a petrol, and this is the thing that I find hilarious, they've still kept the top spec as the petrol because I think that, I don't know, people just... I don't know what the rationale is, but anyway, if you go for the top spec petrol, you get a driveline that runs down the center of the car and you have a hump and all that sort of stuff. There's no driveline down the center of the car in the hybrid because the electric motor services the rear axle. So it is impressive to see that they've been able to actually save weight beyond just adding batteries in it. It's quite a clever setup.
It is, but just to give some credit to that Edge, that's actually using a bigger capacity petrol engine than the other car. So it's a 2.5 yep. liter. So it isn't as gutless. And one thing I'll say about the standard RAV4 petrol was that it felt pretty gutless. And it was good enough for the job, but certainly for $2,500 and given you get your money back, yeah, you just buy the hybrid for the extra power.
I can't remember whether you noted this in the comparison, Alborz, but those two cars you used weren't Toyota press cars. They were actually borrowed from Toyota owners. Did you have a chance to talk to both of them and get their thoughts on their ownership so far?
They weren't actually Toyota owners. They belonged to somebody that didn't want to be known, I suppose, would be the best way to put it. But Look, I've talked to people that have got a Toyota RAV4 hybrid, and it's their first hybrid, and they're pretty happy with it. Like, I got to say, I was pretty happy with it for the short period of time driving it. But I think you'll find what's happening is that people are buying that car that would have previously bought a RAV4 V6, because that base model four-cylinder is just gutless, and they don't want that. And then the salesman obviously goes, why don't you drive the hybrid? And they go, oh, I don't know about a hybrid. They'll drive it and go, hey, this is actually pretty good. Who cares about the fuel economy? That's just a bonus, but it actually drives a lot better. It's got more power. So that's really how they're selling it, and that's what I was told, that that's how they get people into them. It's not necessarily for a fuel economy thing. It's the fact that it's just simply a better car for a little bit more.
And isn't it actually quicker than the old V6 was?
That old V6 was dangerous.
Oh, I remember that front-wheel drive one. That was actually lethal.
I don't like to use the word death trap because legal letters start showing up, but that old V6 was a death trap. So I would not be one I found dead in that car in the rain, because we just wouldn't go anywhere.
God. That comparison is now up at carexpert.com.au, and it actually is a pretty good read. Elbows fella, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mandy. Talk to you guys later.
Guys, once upon a time, I once got a Toyota Hilux bogged in mud. I was with my folks at the time. And because none of us had gone four-wheel driving before, we were playing around with all of the four-wheel drive controls, hoping something might happen. It obviously didn't. Moral to the story, if you're driving a four-wheel drive, it's handy to know how to use those settings. Paul, you thought it might be a good idea to have a discussion about these controls. I want to know, in your early car days, did you ever have a moment like me?
Yes, Mandy, I did. It was when the Hummer H3 was launched in Australia. RIP. Actually, no, not RIP, just RI. Rest. Doesn't need to be in place. Anyway, that thing was a bucket of rubbish, and I went for a drive with Dad in it, and I literally, there was a big branch over the road, and I just went off the side of this little ditch, just a very minor ditch, and the car, it was quite wet and muddy, and the car just started sliding down the ditch. And anyway, stopped it about halfway down, and I thought, oh, I'll just put it into, you know, whatever mode, and we'll get out of this because it's a Hummer. That didn't happen. So we had to walk, because there was no reception, for about a kilometre to find someone, and he came and helped us get it out. So moral of the story is everyone is going to have this happen to them. So we thought, look, I've done since then a whole lot of four-wheel driving and have a whole lot more experience now. And I thought, look, let's put together a video that just explains exactly what all the, you know, switches and stuff mean. And we used a D-Max for it because it has all the basic controls that you'll find in your dual cab ute or your SUV, and that is high range two-wheel drive, four-wheel drive high range, four-wheel drive low range, a rear differential lock, and also hill descent control. So we put together a video that just runs through each of those things. And I think what we found out here, and certainly the one thing that I want to get across to everyone, is that, like you discovered and I discovered, Mandy, when you are stuck, then putting it into the four-wheel drive mode that you need is completely pointless. Because, for example, with a rear differential lock, you need to actually have the car moving, and you need to have a difference in wheel speed for it to engage, and that means being able to turn left and right, and you're not able to do that when the car's stuck. So it is highly important to make sure that you pick the right mode before you actually get started.
What happens when you accidentally leave it in a four-wheel drive setting and then, you know, you're off driving on the freeway? Does this actually do quite a bit of damage to the car?
Yeah, it does actually. And I remember at the old place, they did a trip to the snow, and they had taken up, I won't say what brand it is, but a vehicle that had a two-wheel drive mode normally and then a four-wheel drive mode. They came back from the snow, which was a 3.5-4 hour drive, and I look inside the car and four-wheel drive was engaged, and I thought, oh God, I don't even want to know what condition just the driveline of this car's in.
No.
So the reason it doesn't work is, and I explain this in a whole lot more detail in the video, which you can see on our YouTube channel or at the website carexpert.com.au, but the way that it works is when the vehicle is in two-wheel drive, the rear differential acts as an open diff, and that allows you to turn corners and all that kind of thing. When you get one of those wheels in the air, because it's an open diff, it takes the path of least resistance, which is the tire that's in the air, and it will just sit there aimlessly spinning that wheel. So that's the whole purpose of a rear differential lock. It allows you to have a 50-50 torque split on the rear axle. When you go that one step further and engage four-wheel drive, what you're asking the driveline to do is send 50% of torque to the front axle, 50% to the rear. And it's simple physics from there. When you're in a straight line, all the tires are moving at the same speed. When you start turning, the turning radius of each wheel is going to be completely different because, let's say, example, if you're turning right, the front right wheel is going to have a tighter turning circle than the outside left wheel. And as a result of that, the differential that's been asked to give you 50% of torque to the front, 50% of torque to the rear, is trying to make those wheels turn at the same speed. And as a result of that, if you are on dirt or snow or ice, you're able to have the tire rotate on its own on the spot. Whereas if you're on a sealed surface like bitumen, you're effectively asking it to cause the rubber on the tire to rotate on bitumen, which is virtually impossible to do unless you have enough torque there. So again, this all makes more sense when you see it in action in the video, but that is one of the reasons you can't have a vehicle like this in four-wheel drive, because you will put immense amounts of stress on that driveline.
I know most cars will come with a bit of an instruction manual on how to use these settings, but we know Isuzu do four-wheel drive courses, and I'm sure other manufacturers do too. Do you reckon that they're well worth doing for people who have never been four-wheel driving before?
Absolutely, 100%, because this is the thing. You often don't know what your vehicle's capable of. Even a dual cab ute like the D-Max on highway terrain tyres can still do an incredible amount of off-roading. And really, I mean, there's no point buying all-terrain tyres, getting tow hitches and all this type of thing if you're just going to do the occasional bit of off-roading. But if you are a bit more serious about it, you want to be looking into these things and doing these courses. In fact, Will, I think you did an iVenture Club course with Isuzu recently, right?
Yes, up here in Gordon country, and it was really good. I'm also lucky because I've got a friend of mine who's very knowledgeable about off-roading, and his partner has a Wrangler, so he's kind of taught me the basics there. But if I didn't have a friend like that, and I was just given the keys to a four-wheel drive and told, go and take it off-road, I would have absolutely no clue. So if you do plan on going off-road, one, well, watch Paul's video, but two, it's definitely worth looking into something like in the vein of an iVenture day.
We're looking forward to seeing that video live very soon at carexpert.com.au. And that's an end to this week's podcast. Paul, are you standing up after you fell over after hearing the price of the Mercedes-AMG GT Black Series this week?
Yeah, I knew it was going to be expensive, but I did not think it was going to be $796,000 plus on-road costs. I mean, that is some insane money. I actually did some research because I was curious to see over the SLS Black. And look, the SLS, I think, is more of a unique car because it was the Gullwing, and the Black was ultra limited worldwide. And that was $629,000 plus on roads in Australia in 2013. So I did some calculations on inflation over that period. And if you were to sell that car again today at that rate, it would be about 700,000. So this is about 100 grand up on what that was. So I don't know. It seems like a huge amount of money. It's an immensely capable car, don't get me wrong there. And they've found homes for 28 of them apparently. But yeah, I'm just curious about the pricing.
$428,000 more than a GTR. But they've sold all of the examples they were going to bring here. So people definitely still want it.
Let me just adjust that slightly. So I know someone who was offered one of these cars early on, and the number that they've said they've sold now, 28, was less than the number that was offered to start with. So I suspect that the allocation, maybe it was like the W427. You remember the HSV? Yeah, it was the W427 because they said they were going to cap it at 427, and then the cap got revised to like 300, and then 250, and then it just kept going down. And they were using the excuse of making it rare, but it was like, no, you didn't actually sell them. So yeah, so I don't know. Look, I don't know. Let's see how it goes. I think that if they've sold 28 of them, that shows an incredible amount of interest. And if people are paying that kind of money, well, you know, good on them. I'll be keen to see what these are worth in a few years' time.
Did you do the maths if a Victorian would buy one of these as a drive-away price?
Yeah, so over $200,000 of that price is actually tax in Australia. And then before sort of your final price, the $796,000 is exclusive of stamp duty. So if you're in Victoria, you'd need to put another $71,000 in stamp duty on top of that.
Wow.
Yeah. Crazy.
Let's end the podcast on that note, shall we? If you've got any thoughts of anything we've spoken about this week, please drop us a line, podcast@carexpert.com.au. We look forward to hearing from you. Paul Marrick and William Stopford, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mandy. Cheers.
Thanks, Mandy.